Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast. I am David Chen, and with me are
Devendra Hardwire
and Jeff Cannata.
Welcome to the show, everyone. What we're going to do on today's podcast, we've got some what we've been watching to talk about, tell you about what we've been watching that we recommend, and then we're going to move on into an in-depth review. This week, we're going to be discussing Black Mirror Season 5. All three episodes just debuted on Netflix, so we watch them all, we're going to spoil them all, talk about them later today on the show. That's what we got in store for you. You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Now, before we begin the episode, I do want to read an email that someone wrote to me. Chris from Fairfax, Virginia wrote to us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Chris writes in, quote, "On the last episode, you mentioned apprehension about diving into Chernobyl as if you weren't sure if you could take another depressing show right now." Pretty sure Chris is talking about you, Jeff.
Yeah.
Well, if you need a palate cleanser, I wanted to recommend a great comedic show on Hulu called Pen 15. Bad title, I know. My wife and I found this show to be hilarious. And for anyone who was in middle school or high school in the late 90s or early 2000s, I think you'll find much of the subject matter very familiar. Who doesn't remember setting up their first AIM account and the stress of picking out the perfect screen name? Why is the show brilliant? For one, the two main characters, played by Maya Erskine and Anna Conkle, are great comedic actresses in their 30s, playing 13-year-old versions of themselves. Everyone else in the show is played by age-appropriate actors to the part. If that sounds like just a gimmick to you, I recommend an NYT article below about why it transcends the gimmick. It's mostly comedic, but has a little drama thrown in as well. It's produced by Lonely Island. Hope you get a chance to check it out. Keep up the great work. And then, Chris, here links to an article entitled Pen 15 Goes Crudely, Sweetly Back to School, written by James Poniewozik.
You know, I have seen that show. I forgot to talk about it here. It's funny, but it's also kind of a nightmare because it reminds me exactly of middle school. So I don't know if this is quite the palate cleanser they're saying it is.
I'll never forget when Dan Trachtenberg told me about the Pen 15 Club for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never heard of that. It wasn't a thing. He's a little younger than I. So maybe it was I missed it, but I'd never heard about the Pen 15 Club. In school, did you guys have the Pen 15 Club?
I literally don't even know what you're talking about. Like,
I know of it, but my school did not have it. Yeah,
the Pen 15 Club is kids tell you you have to. If you join the Pen 15 Club, you got to write Pen 15 on your hand. At least this is how Dan explained it to me.
Uh-huh.
And then you effectively have the word penis written on your hand.
Right. So you use permanent marker or something like that.
The prank of now you have penis written on your hand and you have to explain it to the teacher that you think you're in the Pen 15 Club. Everyone laughs at you when you're in the Pen 15 Club and you don't realize that you have penis written on your hand.
It's pretty genius, I have to say.
Yeah.
If I do say so myself.
It's a classic. But yeah. I was unaware of that. I didn't have that in my school. And then I remember very vividly when we were doing the Totally Rad Show, Dan telling me about that at one point and how he fell for it. So yeah, pretty good.
Brutal.
Pretty good.
Brutal.
So now that's what I think of every time somebody mentions that TV show. I'm like, the Pen 15 Club.
Yeah.
Pretty much that. Yeah.
We got an email from Victoria L. in Adelaide, Australia, who writes in, "Hi, /Filmcast folks. Longtime listener, really enjoy your show. I was thinking about Jeff's Cat in the Hat dilemma. Even though I'm not a parent, I sympathize. I wanted to bring to your attention a very popular new kids cartoon here in Australia called Bluey. The episodes are only about 15 minutes each, and it follows the everyday life of an anthropomorphized family of Australian cattle dogs. Caught a few episodes on local TV, and even as an adult, I found it quite enjoyable. One element I found particularly touching, and what might be of interest to Jeff, is the very warm way it represents the dad's playful interaction with his little son and daughter. Just heard the show will be on USA Disney Plus near the end of the year." So, Bluey is the name of the show from Australia. By the way, Jeff,
I gotta say...
Yep.
Let me just read this. Go ahead.
By the way, Jeff, congratulations on your Dungeon Run show. Though not a gamer, I design professional theater productions, and I also have a gaming miniature company called Victoria Miniatures, so it ticks a lot of boxes. I have enjoyed listening to it while at work. Thanks for all you do. Best wishes for the future. Yeah. So that comes in from Victoria from Australia.
Thank you, Victoria.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. I have to say one of the best things about me bringing up my frustrations with the Cat in the Hat knows about that is how many people have recommended better shows. I've gotten a bunch on Twitter and some emails from people saying, "Hey, here's a better show for your kid." One of which we've started watching, which is Stinky and Dirty. And I would never have given this show the time of day because the art, the little, you know, icon for the show is, you know, a tractor or a dump truck and a garbage truck. And then if you turn it on, the first thing is stinky and dirty going out the day. And it's like, oh, it's just inane and, you know, celebrating being dumb. But the show is anything but that. The show is the opposite of that. It is really wonderful. It is the best way I could describe it is that it is like an old school point and click adventure game as a television show for kids. It's problem solving. It's a bunch. It's Stinky and Dirty are these two anthropomorphized trucks, and they run into problems every episode, and then they work through the process of trying to figure out the answers to them. And they try a bunch of different things, and they realize what works and what doesn't, and they sketch things out. And it's kind of like playing one of those old adventure games where you're like, okay, well, let's try putting the bubble gum on the doorknob. No, that didn't work. Okay, let's maybe try using the matchsticks, you know. It's like that, and they're working through a problem, and they realize why that didn't work. And I think it's such great approach to problem solving for kids. But I would never have given it the time of day based on the aesthetic. So thanks to somebody whoever it was that recommended that. And several other people have recommended great shows as well that I'm excited to explore with my 2.5-year-old.
Well, I think what I've just learned, Jeff, is we need to make Jeff sings opening theme songs of children's television shows a regular part of the show. Do DuckTales, Jeff. Do DuckTales. No, I'm just joking.
Do Baby Shark. Do Baby Shark.
Oh, I can do Baby Shark.
And yeah, we can all do Baby
Shark.
Gummy
Bears, that was my favorite. Yeah. I can do Donald Duck. I know, you know that.
Yeah, you're a good Donald Duck impression. Yeah. But anyway, thanks to Victoria for writing in. And you can always write into us at /filmcast@gmail.com. We love reading your emails and reading some of them on the air. All right, let's get to
it. It's a duck blur. Sorry.
let's move on to what we've been watching. Now, I got to apologize is too strong of a word. But
you never do that.
Because, you know, well, yeah, but apologize is too strong of a word. But, like, for reasons passing my control, beyond my control, Devendra got the impression that I was going to watch Dark Phoenix with him this week so we could talk about it and what we've been watching. And if he thought I wasn't going to see it, he might not have busted his ass to go see this movie today.
I ran out middle of the day, left my child to go see this damn movie.
by himself.
Yeah, by herself. Oh, you know.
By herself.
Yeah.
I knew that. I'm sorry, that was lame.
I should have just brought her with me just to see this thing too, but yeah.
I was part of a text chain of that was very clear, of Dave going, hey, Devendra, are you seeing Dark
Phoenix? Why even ask? Why even ask?
And Devendra going, I'll definitely try to see it today. To which Dave did not respond. Oh, I'm not. You know, it clearly seemed like, hey, I've already seen it. Are you seeing it?
Yeah. Well, look. Yeah. Sometimes you can't read the subtext. Sometimes you just got to read the text, which case said absolutely nothing. But Devendra, you went to go see Dark Phoenix anyway, which is an ignominious end for the X-Men, as far as I can tell.
Pretty bad.
I think it was one of the lowest X-Men openings ever, if not the lowest ever. And I was listening to KCRW's The Business Podcast talk about how, in general, Fox has been a pretty good steward of the X-Men franchise. I mean, I think that with some hiccups here and there, they have really milked this cash cow for all it's worth over the last couple decades.
And the hiccups have been pretty bad, to be fair. Like, this was never a Marvel situation for them, but I guess these things were successful enough that it was good for Fox, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, billions of dollars that they've made from this. And I think, I would dare say, we got more good movies than bad out of it, you know?
Yes.
Like, I think we got more good movies than bad, like... X2.
There is some revisionist history happening out here. I see it on Twitter all the time. And people are like, oh, man, I always hated those X-Men movies. They were always terrible. I'm like, X2, guys, X2 is such a perfect movie. It's such a great film.
X2 is great. X-Men 1, yeah. When that first came out.
Low budget, sure.
But it kind of was one of the films that set the template for what could be accomplished with superhero films. X-Men First Class, I think a lot of the visual effects have aged poorly, but it really was a great demonstration of how you could reboot a franchise with younger actors, younger versions of those characters. X-Men Days of Future Past, that movie made over $700 million worldwide when it came out, and it managed to combine two different versions of those characters, a feat that I am still impressed by. Yeah, then you got the Deadpool movies.
Timeline juggling, by the way.
Yeah.
Days of Future Past, I think in the first 10 minutes of Days of Future Past, there's a great little, you know, that whole action sequence in the future.
Yeah.
Like, they just, like, set up all these things. Like, it's so well done.
You got visually. Logan in 2017, which also did extremely well. And then the Deadpool films, which were massive hits.
Not quite connected, but, you know, yeah, enough.
I think there's some scenes that take place at the X Mansion. But yeah, so like overall, there's like a lot of highs, a few lows, but a lot of highs. And so I think we were all hoping that at the very least, Dark Phoenix would kind of bring this franchise to a satisfying conclusion that you're like, okay, hey, we spent so many hours with these characters that are beloved, that it's like, hey, like this kind of puts a nice little bow on it, you know, makes it all kind of worth it.
She should be dead.
Did you hear what the kids are calling you? Phoenix.
Hello, Jean. Who are you? The better question is, who are you?
Something's happening to me.
When I lose control, bad things happen.
But it feels good.
That power destroyed everything it ever came into contact with. Until you. The X-Men fear you. And what they fear, we seek to destroy.
She'll kill us all.
What did you think of Dark Phoenix, Devendra?
Well, it's not great. How about that? It is kind of everything I feared, but I do have to say, like, this is not, I don't think it's a terrible movie. I don't think it's the worst X-Men movie. Certainly X-Men Origins Wolverine is worse than this. X-Men Apocalypse is a movie I loathe the more I think about it. This is a pretty standard X-Men movie with some pretty, solid set pieces. Early on, there's a sequence where the X-Men have to go into space to save astronauts from the space shuttle. So they take the X-plane, they take it into space. This is a great little sequence where Nightcrawler has to, like, teleport through space. It looks really cool. Like, there's a lot of good stuff here. But yeah, it kind of falls apart because this is trying to tell the epic Dark Phoenix saga. That is a thing, you know, beloved in the comics, was kind of a defining thing for Jean Grey as a character. Kind of hard to do as a movie. They already failed to do it in X3.
Well, this will be basically the third time we've seen the Dark Phoenix story depicted on screen. X3 was obviously supposed to be a Dark Phoenix origin story.
Yeah.
But the filmmakers and most of the world seem to have forgotten that at the end of X-Men Apocalypse, Charles Xavier is like, use your powers, Jean, you know, and like she theoretically becomes Dark Phoenix in that movie, which I believe is not even referenced.
Calling. She was like, it's a thing that was supposed to lead to this, basically. Like, the whole idea is that, you know, the entity or whatever is being attracted to Jean. So I think if there were some better narrative involved, she didn't quite become Dark Phoenix there, but it was kind of, it's a whole thing. It's a whole thing about Jean Grey and her untapped potential, yada, yada, yada. This movie is kind of a mess. Written and directed by Simon Kinberg, who has written some of the other X-Men movies. Notably, also, I think, co-wrote X3. So it's like another attempt for him to retell this story. It does feel like the work of a first-time filmmaker. Like, narratively, it's kind of sloppy. It's not super visually distinctive. Some of the pieces do look good. But I think the thing about this movie is that, in general, the blood was in the water, basically. Like, people sensed a franchise kind of flailing, and it is kind of funny and fascinating to watch entertainment media, like, just really go at something, right? You know, like, oh man, look at this limping little franchise. Oh, they're going to release a movie. Oh man, it's very cute. You know, amidst like Avengers Endgame and everything. Like, it's just, it seems like the narrative was kind of self-written in a way. Like, and also audiences also don't seem to be really interested in another X-Men movie after Apocalypse. So there's a lot of blood in the water, I'd say. I look at the Rotten Tomatoes score, which is very, very low. Yeah, I don't think it's like as bad as a lot of the reporting I'm hearing, but certainly it's not a great movie. It's just kind of a tough thing to talk about. Like, I wish the franchise had something better to go out on. Something like Logan, which actually wrapped up the storylines, you know, for Hugh Jackman and for Patrick
other
Stewart
characters.
As Xavier.
Yeah.
The idea that you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm kind of a Marvel zombie from way back, and the idea that they would make a big budget Hollywood version of the Dark Phoenix saga, and I would have no desire to go see it.
Yeah,
just, it kind of boggles my mind.
The timing is pretty bad, I think, because it's like amidst Avengers mania. Like, we're still like reeling from Endgame. We're all like a little superheroed out. Apocalypse was so bad. Somebody had a report about basically the mess involved with this movie. Was it a Hollywood Reporter?
Deadline.
Yeah, yeah.
You notice whenever a movie does badly, there's always like a lot of people who want to talk to the trades about why it went badly.
Yeah.
And how it's specific people's fault that it went badly. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Really,
but we should say that Simon Kinberg, like, in my opinion, Simon Kinberg is like an incredibly talented screenwriter. He directed an episode of The Twilight Zone this year. He's also like behind the Twilight Zone reboot, but he's also contributed to some of my favorite movies, like Mr. and Mrs. Smith. He was involved in the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes.
I'm surprised not mentioned Jumper.
Yeah, Jumper, great film, great film. Days of Future Past, you know, so like
he's had a good run, but there's also like he did that Fantastic Four, the reboot. Like, it's, he is credited for X-Men Apocalypse. Like, these things are a mess because a lot of people are involved, right? So it's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell who, like, who's responsible for who. I did hear that I'm not 100% sure, so like, don't hold me to this, but I think I read that he helped to take over Fantastic Four after Josh Trank was kind of removed from that project.
And also pretty much the same with X-Men Apocalypse, according to that Deadline story. Mm-hmm. So he is the guy who kind of comes in when directors kind of fall apart, which, I mean, not really a solid point, though, because the end result with those movies were still kind of a mess. So, yeah.
Well, I think he's worked on, I think he's gotten more hits than misses. I'm sorry to hear that this one didn't go super well. And like, from everything I've read about the film, I haven't seen it yet, obviously, but from everything I've read, it's the biggest issue with Dark Phoenix is that it doesn't evolve. Like, it doesn't evolve the X-Men franchise from its origins. Like, it's a lot of the exact same dynamic between like Charles and what's his name, Magneto.
No, I mean, not quite. I think there are some things, like in this movie, Charles Xavier is basically kind of a drunken megalomaniac, and I think that's kind of interesting. Like, this guy who brings in all these, you know, talented mutant children, in this movie at least, is portrayed as like kind of an asshole who's like putting these kids in danger for his own self gain and like to make mutants look better. Like, there are some interesting ideas they toss around in this movie.
So it's not the same thing as, it's not like the whole like, oh, Eric thinks they're evil and Charles thinks they're good dynamic.
They maybe bounce around a little what's happened before in the movies, but it's not that. Like, it is a little different. Like, those are things I kind of appreciate. I think the very last half, maybe the last third of this movie, is a complete mess. And that's also maybe why so many of the reviews are just vicious about it, because you could tell like there were some last act problems. A lot of the final set piece, there's a set piece in New York, which is just kind of a mess. It just doesn't work and it's kind of boring. The most boring mutant superpower fight I can imagine, set, you know, in a New York City street. So yeah, a lot of problems. I wish the series had a better time to run out, basically. But I don't know, like, what do you do with the X-Men now? You basically wait 5 years and maybe bring them into the MCU somehow, I guess. That's the only path for it.
Probably. That seems like where things are going. So that's Dark Phoenix. That's what Devendra's been watching. Devendra, are you watching anything else this week?
Also, I've been watching the latest season of Bosch season 5. I wish more people were watching Bosch. Basically, I have nobody to talk about Bosch. I go outside and I shout Bosch. Yeah. I get nothing.
You need to hang out with my in-laws. It's all they talk about.
It is a very good like parent show. Like this is a show. My dad loves the show. I have talked to dads and like older folks who really dig it. For five seasons, I've been telling you people. Go watch Bosch. Okay, basically it is a police procedural. It is very much a procedural where the police chief is always shouting Bosch, and you know, he's always getting trouble. He's always doing things his own way. But it is so fun and pulpy and so well made. It is such a great like neo noir look at like a modern LA detective. And it's just the right amount of campy, right? I've mentioned this before. Similar to Miami Vice. Bosch lives in a multi-million-dollar mansion on the Hollywood cliffsides, I guess, because at some point he sold the rights to his story and they made a movie about his story within the show. So that's why he has a fancy mansion. And it's just one of those things. It's like Miami Vice and Crockett having a houseboat and an alligator. It's like one of those cute, campy things. I really dig it. The show's still very good and acting great all around. If you like cop shows, I think this is the... This is like the culmination of so many great pulpy cop shows. Watch it if you like cop stuff.
All right. That's Bosch Season 5. It is streaming right now on Amazon Prime Video. I saw a bunch of stuff. Let's see how much I can get through in the next 10, 15 minutes. First of all, I want to mention that I saw Always Be My Maybe on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a romantic comedy starring Randall Park and Ali Wong. And I had a great time watching it. It is kind of this year's Crazy Rich Asians, I would say, in the sense that, from what I can tell, it's a very successful movie that stars two Asian American leads, and it's like a fun romantic comedy that nails many aspects of the Asian American experience in a way that I found to be very charming and endearing.
There is one scene in that movie where kids walk into a house, take off their shoes, hold their shoes, the camera tracks them as they walk through the house and go to the backyard, and then put their shoes back on. I kind of love that because I also had to do that with my family.
It is great. I want to plug a video I made with my wife about Always Be My Maybe. We basically watched the entire film and then talk about many of the aspects of it that we found resonated with our own experiences. So we'll link to it in the show notes. And you can also find it on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. If you want a 30-minute discussion of Always Be My Maybe, that's where you should go. Okay. And we talked about that scene, Devendra, where there is a shot where these kids run into a house and they run out the back and they take off their shoes when they
so
go
good.
In. And they could have just
things
they didn't,
like that.
They
yeah.
didn't need to put that in the movie. They could have just started that that scene in the backyard,
yep.
but they
yep.
showed it to be like, hey, these kids are extremely well behaved and they understand.
This is how it works.
This is
okay.
how it works, yeah. And so
I also love like this is a good it's a good thing for basically Randall Park and also his fresh off the boat director, Nanachka Khan.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're getting the crew back together, making this thing. I will say it's really enjoyable. I think I don't know, I feel like I wish they had a little more time to like polish up the script or something. Because this is one of those comedies that relies a lot on ADR jokes. So it does feel like sometimes they like throw in like a quip, like after the fact, like after it was filmed or something, and things don't quite connect sometimes. But overall, still fun and a great great cameo in there, too.
Yeah, agreed. Always Be My Maybe. It's on Netflix right now. It's a fun romantic comedy, pretty family friendly overall. I think it's well worth checking out, and especially if you're Asian American. It's amazing that we have the opportunity to see our stories on the small and big screen these days and to share them with the world. And I think films like Always Be My Maybe allow that to happen. So
it's really the little things, too. Like there's one scene in this movie where a character is preparing kanji in like very lovingly and very beautifully. And it is just like it is a thing done with respect for the dish. And then I also saw The Perfection, which I'll talk about that later at some point, I guess. The Perfection in that movie, kanji is this gross dish. That one scene was kind of shitty.
Anyway, Always Be By Maybe on Netflix. Check it out. Speaking of films on Netflix, I had a chance to check out I Am Mother, which is a new science fiction movie. And I will be extremely vague in describing the plot. It's basically like this girl... wakes up in this scientific facility, this kind of sci-fi-esque facility with a robot that calls itself her mother. And she is kind of like raising the robot kind of raises this girl, and you as the viewer are like privy to what happens with them. And you're kind of just like the whole movie, you're just trying to figure out like what is actually going on here? Like what is the relationship between these characters? Like what is the backstory here? How do they wind up in this situation? And it kind of presents like a really interesting mystery. And so I actually quite liked this movie. I think it is not quite as good as a movie like Moon, but it's extremely similar in terms of its themes and its quality. And I would nonetheless recommend it. I find it to be a very engrossing movie. It raises similar questions to movies like Moon and The Matrix about what it means to be human and humankind's relationship to technology. And it has an amazing performance by the main actress, Clara Rugard, who anchors this movie. And it's really rare to see a child performance or somebody in her teens anchor a film in a way that I really appreciated and was like, wow, that was like a really great performance. But this actress in I Am Mother does that. So recommend it. Have you guys heard of this? It might have popped up on your Netflix recommendations.
Yeah,
I'm definitely interested to see.
Yeah, check it out. It looks good.
I will say, do not watch the Netflix trailer. They have a bad habit of just like spilling everything about their movies in the trailers. Like they are much worse than Hollywood trailers. I don't know what is up with Netflix.
Yeah, Jeff, do not. Which for Jeff means like you cannot even pause the cursor. Yeah.
Gotta keep moving like a shark.
Yeah,
don't pause.
Yeah, you can only pause it on something you've already watched.
Didn't Edgar Wright yelled at them about their trailer for The World's End, which kind of just put like the twist of that movie right out there.
Mm.
Whereas I think all the theatrical trailers tried to like hint around it basically.
You know what I do? You know what my actual it's funny you guys bring this up, but my actual Netflix strategy is always pause on a stand-up comedy special.
Wow,
because those trailers are delightful.
It's good.
Nice.
No spoilers.
Good strategy.
There.
Good strategy.
I mean, I guess you spoil a few jokes, but no big whoop.
All right. Well, that's I Am Mother, and it's available on Netflix right now. Also wanted to give a quick shout out to a movie called The Farewell, which is directed by Lulu Wong. I actually had a chance to interview Lulu at the Seattle International Film Festival. Had a great time speaking with her. That conversation will be out at slashfilm.com in July. And I'll just say what the premise of The Farewell is. It is a movie about a struggling artist played by Awkwafina, who's showing a side of herself that she doesn't usually show on the big screen. This is a very like tender, understated role that's unlike anything I've seen from her before. And she finds out her grandmother is dying. And her family does not tell her, as is Chinese custom. Apparently, her family does not tell her grandmother that her grandmother's dying. So they find out the test results, and they don't tell her because they don't want to distress her. Because apparently, like it in Chinese culture, like the fear of dying is almost as bad as actually having the thing that might kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And I was stunned when I watched this movie because I didn't know that was something that was prevalent in Chinese culture. It's something that would literally be illegal in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
But apparently people do. I texted my parents after watching this movie. I said, hey, I saw this movie called The Farewell. And apparently, like, people don't tell people that they're dying. And my mom was like, yeah, that's a thing that happens. I'm like, oh. This is a movie that actually helped me, like, connect with my culture in a meaningful way. I actually thought this movie was great. It is going to be out in theaters in July. It's going to be distributed by A24, which is a company that does a really good job picking great films that you might not otherwise get a chance to see. You know, like film festival darlings that wouldn't otherwise get wide distribution. A24 picks them up, sends them out into the world, and that's what's going to happen with The Farewell in July. And I strongly recommend this movie. This is another movie that features a lot of Asian Americans. It is not at all like Crazy Rich Asians, though, because it deals with very different themes. But it is still very meaningful, very heartfelt, and very illustrative of the Asian American experience, or at least the Chinese American experience, in ways that I found to be surprising and moving. So that is The Farewell, and I watched it at the Seattle International Film Festival this year. And that's what I've been watching. You know, there's a couple other things I do. I'll give a quick shout out to The Act, which is a movie, a show, I should say, that was recommended by one of our listeners. And I will say the reason I'm not going to go into full review is because I found this show so upsetting.
Oh yeah,
that I couldn't pay full attention to it watching it. You know, like what I mean by that is like I would like let it play in the background, and like maybe I skipped a couple episodes because it is extremely distressing what happens.
You didn't stop watching it, but no. You just stopped paying attention to
Listen, it's 2019. We can't not watch things, okay?
Because the craft is actually really good, Jeff. Like yeah. it's actually like a really well made show. But
which you would probably notice if you paid attention.
That's
to it.
Right. That's correct. But yeah, the performances by Joey King and Patricia Arquette are marvelous.
This is based on that real life story.
It's
too,
based
right?
on a real life story, which we will not yeah. like. I knew so little about it.
You can't even mention like what the thing
I don't even
is.
Want to reveal what the premise is. Don't even want to reveal what the premise is.
I will say like this. This show is also created by Nick Antosca, who did Channel Zero that I recommended a couple years ago, and that's a horror show. So yeah. I feel like he's bringing some of that over here.
I had just finished watching Chernobyl, and I'm not lying. Watching The Act was more upsetting than watching Chernobyl because Chernobyl was largely a story about like incompetence and you know institutions and lies that were damaging. But many of the lies were not committed maliciously. Do you know what I mean? Like. People were just trying to save their own ass, or they were trying to like fall in line into the with the party line, toe the line with the party. The Act is about like acts of wanton cruelty that is like really difficult to comprehend for me, and I imagine for you guys. I mean, Devendra, have you seen the show? How much of the show have you seen?
I've seen the first couple episodes.
Yeah, so like as parents, like I would imagine mm-hmm. that. You would find it to be like unbelievable what happens in this.
Yeah,
show.
I don't think I'm going to keep watching for a while. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, like, what like the premise is crazy, and then what happens afterwards is like even more outlandish and ludicrous. So, I this kind of sent me down a rabbit hole. Like, I kind of like read you know a dozen articles about what actually happened with the real life case that this is based on. I can't say that I watched the whole thing because for reasons I've already explained, but I do think that the situation that The Act is about is fascinating, and the performances are really, really solid and like enough to make me recommend this show, which is on Hulu right now. So that's The Act. It's on Hulu. Thanks to our listener who wrote in about that. Jeff Cannata, my question for you is... You know, I messaged Jeff this after our discussion last week, but like Jeff, are you going to be able to watch Chernobyl or The Act, or are any of these shows going to make it onto your radar?
I think at some point I'll watch Chernobyl. I'm not going to watch The Act.
Yeah, I think that's smart. That's probably for the
wise move. Wise move.
But yeah. I definitely think you should watch. Like, I think like Chernobyl is so your jam. You know what I mean? Like, it is.
Yeah, my wife and I have already talked about it. We got. You know, we're finishing up Fleabag right now. And then we got season 3 of Sneaky Pete because we're huge Sneaky Pete fans. Mm. And then I think Chernobyl might be after that.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing your thoughts on it once you finish it. So that's what we've been watching this week. Before we move on, we got to thank our donors for this week. There is a donor who wanted me to shout out his 3-minute short film called Mulk, M-U-L-K. You can find it by Googling Mulk Esposito with an E-S.
What a typo. Yep. What a typo.
I don't know if that's a typo, but yeah. We also got a donation from Joey Jacket Big Butt of the Northeastern Big Butts.
Nice.
So
Northeastern Big Butts, very famous.
Thanks to Joey Jacket Big Butt for that donation. Thanks to James H. from New York City, New York, for his donation as well. And if you want to support the Slash Filmcast, help us defray the cost of doing the show, going to see films like Dark Phoenix, You can go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. Or go to /film.com. Use the PayPal links on the side of the page on the /filmcast tab. Never donate if it in any way causes you hardship. But if you do want to support us, we really appreciate it. And of course, if you want to support us for free, just go to Apple Podcasts, go to wherever you get your podcasts, leave a review for us, leave a star rating. It takes a few seconds and it's free. So thanks so much for all of our donors this week. Really appreciate it. Let's move on to our review of Black Mirror Season 5.
There's a whole load of police here. I think they're worried you're going to hurt yourself. Or someone else.
Lonely feelings.
Family life. It's boring.
Lonely feelings.
So here she is again.
What is it? Is it me?
Lonely feeling.
I don't have any friends.
Rachel, you look incredible.
You've got 20,000 fans out there.
Knock them dead.
Before we dive into spoilers for every single one of these episodes, let's just like take a moment to give like overall thoughts on the season. I think like for many people, what I've perceived is Black Mirror has kind of become a parody of itself. Like people are really, from my like very insulated Twitter bubble timeline, people seem to be like not super excited about Black Mirror anymore. That it's just basically like extremely monotonous and very much like, oh, it's the same message all the time. Technology is evil. The message is so simplistic, blah, blah, blah. And so I was kind of curious. And also like coming off of Bandersnatch, which I thought was pretty bad, I was very doubtful that Black Mirror season 5.
But at least interesting, right? That was a good experiment.
You got to try things, you know? You got to try to push the art form forward, and I do admire that. But like, that's a season or episode that I've never gone back to and have no regrets about not going back to. So in that context, I was very nervous that Black Mirror season 5 would be a complete waste of time. And I actually thought it was decent, is what I would say. I thought there was enough interesting ideas here that I actually did not regret my time in the Black Mirror universe. How about you, Devinder Hardwar?
I will say decent is a good word. Yeah, I think overall, like, I enjoyed the last season more, the last full season, which was season 4, with a USS Callister and all those fun things.
Great
episode. Like, Hang the DJ and Metalhead, which I like Metalhead just because it was such a specific thing. That season had 6 episodes, so it was able to, like, have a couple misses and still be great overall, I'd say. But last season, I definitely noticed, like, man, Charlie Brooker just needs some new blood in this franchise. Like, he needs some writing help because it seems like he's hitting the same ideas again over and over.
And I think we should say, like, he's apparently the only credited screenwriter of every single episode.
There are a couple that he didn't. USS Callister, he co-wrote with somebody, and there was another one, Shut Up and Dance. And,
yeah, but this season, yeah. I think he is.
This season is everything. Yeah. And
you can
feel that because a lot of the, I think they all kind of echo the last, like, some of the ideas he's explored already. There are some notable things, like, I think when we talk about Striking Vipers, like the context of that is kind of interesting in the way he explores it. But overall, it just feels weak to me. It feels like he needs some new blood. Even Twilight Zone guy was able to, like,
Simon Kinberg. Jordan Peele?
No, the original Twilight Zone.
Rod Serling?
Rod Serling was able to bring in, like, he wrote most of those episodes, which is genius, like, insane. But he still also brought in, like, notable science fiction writers for some episodes, too. And I think that kind of helped out. So maybe you got to take a page from that.
So I think you're saying there's a bit of sameness that kind of has seeped into the writing and the ideas of the show, but there is enough decent there to make it worth talking about.
I think it's worth watching. I just think the earlier seasons are much, much better. Going to do the hipster thing because they felt sharper. They felt more interesting at the time. Maybe the problem is we basically live in a Black Mirror episode now. So
yeah,
his commentary maybe has a little less weight. But I fleshed out my ideas more at an Engadget article, too. So just look that up, too.
Many Black Mirror things that have been foretold, right? Like, many of the things that Black Mirror warned us against have actually come true. And I think that's what you're referring to, right? Like, how can we, like, you just need to kick it up a notch if you're going to continue to be successful as a show, and maybe you're experiencing some diminishing returns there.
Yeah.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts on Black Mirror Season 5 overall?
Well, Dave, I guess you could say my thoughts about Black Mirror Season 5 are best summed up in the form of two limericks.
Whoa. Two limericks.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, I couldn't be done with just one.
Yeah.
First one, 4 seasons of Mirror's Dark. So many episodes hit the mark. But in Season 5, it takes a nosedive. Has it actually jumped the shark?
Nice.
I didn't know if it was a two-parter limerick.
No, the second one, the reason the first one exists is because the second one is a stretch. But I went for it, and I feared you guys would get mad. So here's the second one. The show used to make my fears clearer about what tomorrow brings nearer. If that's what it does, it's perfect because Black Mirror maybe just got Black Mirrored.
Wow. Ooh.
Nice.
You get it? See, if it's like about the fact that if you keep progressing, things get bad. Then if the show kept progressing, things got bad on the show. I don't know. It was kind of a stretch. So I was like, it's not going to be good. People are going to hate
it. It works. Yeah, sure.
Good effort.
Yeah, I guess I agree with you guys that there is stuff worth seeing. I will get into the details. I think there's one episode that I would say is good. But I think in Season 5, basically, there are 3 amazing act ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
And usually this show is all about an awesome act 3. You know, like that's the sort of Twilight Zone Black Mirror model, is the act 3 that hits you like a wallop. And yeah, there are always great ideas in this series. And that's what I love. I love the, you know, just around the corner idea of what technology is going to do to our lives. And this season retains that brilliant view of what the subtlety of what tech might be like day after tomorrow. I love that. Every episode has a beautiful piece of just pure design of what technology may do to our lives. Although I guess the second episode doesn't, because is it the only episode of Black Mirror that takes place present day?
I think the very first episode of Black Mirror ever also takes place in present day.
Mm. That was very much present day.
Yeah. Yeah. There's several that take place kind of in present day. So
anyway, yeah. I think generally speaking, the first and third episodes have great sort of future tech design moments. And there are still really clever ideas. The show isn't hurting for ideas. It just never sticks the landing. Mm-hmm. And it feels like, I mean, we'll get into details on the specific episodes, but each of them feels really simplistic and unsophisticated in a show that has always been very sophisticated and complex. And I find that to be disappointing, which is why I posited the question that it may have jumped the shark. I hope that's not the case. I love this show and I want more of it, but it this season really felt like a low point for me.
Oh, wow. Okay. Even lower than Bandersnatch, you think?
Bandersnatch, I don't even. It was doing something so different.
Yeah, yeah.
That it was just like felt like an experiment. It wasn't part of an actual season. It was just this one-off thing, and it felt to me like this wild experiment that succeeded sometimes and didn't other times, and had a lot to do with me and what I did. And mm-hmm. You know, it didn't feel like I wouldn't say that was a failure or a success. I mean, I guess I would make it a success. It was something different and really interesting and bizarre.
I had a lot of fun with Bandersnatch. I didn't regret my time with it. Even
I agree.
It was a couple hours. Yeah.
All right. Well, why don't we dive into the specific episodes then? So from now on, from this point forward, when we mention an episode title, you should assume that we're going to spoil it. All right. So here we go for spoilers for Black Mirror Season 5, starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
Let's start with the first episode, Striking Vipers. Now, Jeff Cannata...
By the way, I can imagine Charlie Brooker cackling at himself when he came up with that title, because that is like that is like a Reynolds Woodcock level of like a really, really cheesy, funny title that's kind of like immature at the same time, but he makes it work in this.
My first reaction was Striking Viper sounds like a dumb name for a video game, but is it any dumber than Mortal Kombat with a K?
No. It works for the game, and it works for what the show is implying, basically.
Yeah. All right. So, Jeff, you had a pretty interesting experience. You had a chance to watch this episode of Black Mirror with your mother. Is that correct?
Yeah, I had a chance. I had that awesome chance.
Oh, boy.
So my mom was my wife went out of town for work for several days, and my mom came into town to help out with childcare. And I knew I had to watch this for the show. And literally every other episode of Black Mirror I've ever watched in my life would have been just fine and dandy to watch with my mom. I think she
would have been fine with the pig sex, even.
Well, yeah. Okay, maybe that one would have been a little, but even that is just like is more of like a humorous what if than an entire episode of a hardcore pounding. Yeah, I mean, it could not have worked out more badly.
That's
for
comedy.
Me.
Comedy, right?
It
there.
Was literally like literally any other of the episodes of if that hadn't been the first one. I just sat down. I was like, "Hey, mom, I gotta watch Black Mirror. Do you want to watch an episode with me before you go to bed?" Sure. I'm intrigued by the show. Let's turn it on.
It starts. This, by the way, is where watching trailers could really help you out.
Yeah, I guess. But I mean, this everything the show had shown me before. I grant you the pig screwing episode was extreme, but even that is like, I don't think that would even have been a big deal with my mom because it's so out there and weird.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
This was just like, I'm sitting there with these extended sex scenes sitting next to my mom, just going, please end, please, please end, please end. Yeah. And then she turns to me at the end and she's like, I just don't understand why the sex with each other in the video game was better than real life. And I was like, I don't know, mom.
Oh, I thought she'd be like, is this what you do, Jeff?
Yeah, this is my job, mom. This is my job. Aren't you proud? Yeah, it was excruciating. So I'm sure part of my reaction to this episode is colored slightly by that experience. But I also think, again, a really wonderful first act, despite jumping right in with sexy time as young people, I have lived that thing that they show at the beginning, which is, you know, you marry the love of your life.
I thought you were talking about having sex indiscriminately at clubs, but you're not.
Well, let's not go into that, David. No, but I mean, the whole point was that they were a very committed relationship and they were just role playing at the beginning. And it's very much, a wonderful relationship that then transforms as we jump 11 years later into being married with kids and different responsibilities. I have lived
the suburbs,
suburbs. Right? So I was relating hard to this show and I was like, oh man, this is so well realize this feeling of like, oh man, you've settled down and you're living different lives now. And I was relating to it. Not that I feel any, you know, bad about my life, but just that you have that sense of connection. And I felt like it really was doing that well. And then I'm a video gamer and like friends that you don't see anymore and all that stuff. I was like in it. And I honestly feel like this episode could have worked in a weird way of presenting this notion, as Black Mirror has done in the past, of how technology is going to change interpersonal relationships in the future. But I don't think this episode really cared about making that point. They could have easily made it about how when we have technology and we're able to relate to each other in a virtual space, there's going to be different rules. But it played it for a goofy factor. And I think a lot of that is because for some dumb reason, the show was determined to make this a fighting game that turned into a sex game rather than doing the much, I think, more obvious and believable thing, which is have it be some virtual reality space where all of that is possible. But throughout
the
whole
Jeff, I've played Dead or Alive. I know why some people play Dead or Alive. Okay. Like this is not that far of a stretch.
You're talking about jiggle physics. I know you're talking about jiggle physics. But I found myself just going down the dumb rabbit hole in my head that the show should never have put me down, which is, why does this game work like this? How is the functionality built into this fighting
game?
Didn't
they know this would happen?
Yeah, it's the stupidest thing, and it makes the whole thing feel hokey and lame when the show really doesn't want you to feel that way. It wants you to actually think about who these guys are and what it means for them, and it's taking itself super seriously. But I could never go there because of how goofball the whole thing played.
I think they're not. So I think like a couple things, right, that are evident about the fighting game is it's preposterous that the people who made this fighting game would then also program that, like, the sex functionality into it. Like, yeah, that is,
and
at
also,
best,
even the pain functionality. Like, why would they program me to feel pain?
Right.
It makes me think of that.
At best, the sex function is an orthogonal function to the main purpose of the game. At best.
I think we're supposed to believe that the simulation is so extreme that you are able to do literally anything you want in there.
Right.
Which also is a huge stretch, because why would you do that and then just put it out as a fighting game? You know?
It's like we've mastered this like person simulation technology that is like groundbreaking.
Why not sell that? Yeah.
Well, that's the thing Jeff pointed out when I was texting with him about this, is like they could have easily just made this like a Second Life type of game, you know? But the fact that it's a fighting game, you know, I think the fighting game, obviously, like there's something this episode wants to say about these people, these characters, like masculinity, and like how it manifests itself through these games. And you know, Kotaku recently released an article about how, like, for men, gaming is a way to keep in touch that like you can't otherwise do on the phone. You know, like most guys,
I'm not going to call you up and just say, "Hey, let's hang out for an hour and chat."
Yeah,
but if we're both doing some inane, you know, we're both playing Destiny 2 and even really talking, we're just sort of doing that in the background while what we're really there for is to have a 2-hour conversation with each other.
Exactly, exactly. And like, so for many men, like video games are a huge part of their social fabric, and I don't know that the show really said anything interesting about that, but I think that it like at least uses that as the backdrop in a way that I thought is like very appropriate for the times.
I think it's very like it's relatable for a lot of the audience too. It's a nice little bait and switch, basically. It's like, oh yeah, I've always like just hung around at night and I get a friend request from a friend to jump into something. Like it happens to everybody. Does not happen like this, I will say. does not go down this line usually.
Davinja, did you like this episode?
I really like this episode. Here's the thing.
Really?
I think this is the strongest episode of the season, because at least I think what Charlie Brooker is bringing up here is, first of all, two men who find this like connection, two men basically having sex together. But virtually, one of the men also has a female avatar and really enjoys that experience, too. Like, it doesn't. I really appreciate the fact that this episode didn't really make fun of any of this. Like, it does feel like it handles a lot of this respectfully. And by the end, we get to a situation where, like, okay, the relationship that works out is that, you know, the husband and wife kind of agree to this situation. And the wife is free to go do her own thing. Maybe not the thing she signed up for when she got married, but she's free to do something else. It's kind of like a future open marriage, in a way, and I found that really interesting and really respectful, at least. So I like that about it. I don't like the, oh man, the suburbs are pretty bad, huh? Really sucks to live in the suburbs, because nothing has ever made this commentary before. Like, that stuff I could care less about.
Also, aren't you thinking about moving to the suburbs, Devendra? Is that something you're considering?
I mean, who knows? Because, like, first of all, you can't afford to buy a place in New York. That's a whole other separate thing. But yeah, it's sort of like, I don't need that American Beauty commentary, because we've seen it so much. But I think Anthony Mackie really sells this. Yahya Abdul-Mateen sells relationship. Like, there's the interpersonal stuff, I think, is really interesting. So even though the mechanics of like, oh, this being a fighting game really doesn't make sense, that's fine. I think it was like a fun way to have a lark of a basically a Black Mirror Mortal Kombat fully realized fight sequence and fully realized world. And I found that kind of funny. Like the even the little bits where they are actually fighting, I think look really fun. We have not seen that in any like live action thing since like what the Mortal Kombat movies, I
well,
guess.
Well, I would say that what this those fighting scenes were okay, extremely silly. And they really made me appreciate what Edgar Wright did in Scott Pilgrim versus
yes.
the World.
Yes, oh yes, yes, Scott Pilgrim.
like if you rewatch like the fighting scenes of Scott Pilgrim versus the World, that is it made me realize like that is probably one of the truest realizations we will ever yes. see of that concept.
Yes.
And it is also much superior to what we see in this episode, which, you know, whatever. This is one episode of a, you know, season five of a show, so I don't expect the production value to be that high. But it's kind of like once you've seen Scott Pilgrim, it kind of ruins you on this kind of thing because it's like very, very few things can actually measure up to that in terms of using yeah. cinema to actually depict a fighting game. So my thoughts on this episode, Jeff, I actually also thought it was more good than bad. Here are the great things about it. One is that Anthony Mackie's performance is amazing, as well as the actor who plays his wife in this episode. There is a deadness in his eyes and his affect that is going to haunt me for the rest of my life.
That's really all there is, though, in this episode for him.
For the opening part of the episode, like the way he like goes through the motions of suburban life is just terrifying. It's like... you know what other random thing came to mind is like when, you know, in It's a Wonderful Life when like the guy, Jimmy Stewart, comes back and he like is in, he's talking to like the cabbie and like that guy, that cab driver has like such a miserable look on his face. It's kind of like these small moments that show you like the intense misery that these characters live in all the time, for which you are just intercepting them at a small part of, is truly haunting. And I think they do a great job. And like, there is the stuff between him and his wife is extremely compelling. It is really like, it doesn't barely even has to do with technology, right? It's about like what happens when a marriage goes on for an extremely long time and the passion is gone. It reminded me honestly of like Fences, the Denzel Washington movie, and like there's like some great speechifying in that about like their marriage, the marriage between Denzel Washington's character and Viola Davis' character, and like the things they have had to give up in order to endure. And so like I really love the kind of depiction of suburban and marital malaise in this episode and found it to be very powerful. The other thing that I like about this episode is that it is actually overall pretty hopeful about technology. Like most Black Mirror most Black Mirror episodes end really depressingly, and this one is actually like, hey, this technology has allowed these people to kind of like open up this space in their marriage that theoretically makes them happier, or that theoretically allows them to self-actualize. And that idea, I think, is pretty interesting and pretty well executed. What I didn't like about the episode was everything else. And what I mean by that is, I think a lot of people brought up the problem of this episode is that like you don't really understand the character's relationship in this episode, right? Mm-hmm. The relationship between Danny and Carl, like, okay, so like one of them happens to have a female avatar. Like, did he purposely choose a female avatar? Like, And by the way, I just have to say, if this thing actually existed in the real world, the first thing that guys would do if they were messing around with this game is try out all the different crazy shit that you could do.
I was just going to say that another reason why it makes no sense for this to be a fighting game is because you don't just pick one avatar.
Yes.
Ever.
Yes.
You know,
I think all this hinges, by the way, in that first scene that they have together where those two guys are just playing video games late at night and like they play it all through the night, like into the morning. I think they even say they're like, oh, yeah, I only just pick one person. Basically.
Yeah, but that it's such a contrivance. Like anybody that's ever played a fighting game, if you play all through the night, at a certain point, you're like, OK, well, I'm losing. I'm going to try a different character. That's just how those games are played. And it feels like bending so many things for very little gain of whatever the gain of is of like, well, it's violent, it's masculine, it's aggressive, it's versus each other instead of loving each other, and then it turns into loving each other. But you have to jump through so many hoops and ask the audience to suspend so much disbelief when it was sitting right there. There's plenty of choose your avatar, be in a virtual world, and then have relationship. Like, I would buy all of that if it felt more like a Second Life or like a Ready Player One style virtual reality where you have this avatar in this virtual world and you do whatever you do in it. It just doesn't make any sense that it was a fighting game. It just made it all goofy.
I think that this is alluded to a little bit at the end when I think it's Carl talks about like how he tried to have sex with all these other characters.
Yeah.
And it's like, I even tried to have sex with a polar bear and it didn't work out. And it's like, that is the first thing that those characters would have done is like, let's try the polar bear and you be like, you know, the undead zombie creature, you know, like,
yeah, no. And also, so we're supposed to, there's literally a line in the show where he describes how different it is having an orgasm as a woman. What about, do we know what having an orgasm as a polar bear is like?
Yes. That's the first thing I would want to know, Jeff. That is the first thing I would want to find out.
We're missing the bigger picture here, but yes, okay.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I just feel like it is so authentic to the female experience, but did the designers build in the polar bear experience and the, you know, like what the hell?
Yeah. So I think that the movie, aside from taking this like very broad position, I'm sorry, not the movie, the episode, but aside from taking this broad position that like, oh, technology lets you explore your sexuality in different ways, like it doesn't really have that much to say about what these characters' sexuality actually is. Like, I think it says that like just because they engage in this activity in the game, like they're not, that doesn't mean they are homosexual, you know, like that sexuality is like very fluid and that, you know, but like beyond that, like kind of very general statement, we know so little about these characters. Like we don't know, like did they always like love each other? You know, were they always sexually attracted to each other? Like we know so little about them that I don't think the episode can really say that much about what the technology does for them.
And my favorite scene in the whole episode was the one where they meet in their own like real life fighting game level with the rain coming down and try to kiss and then and realize, oh, OK, no, there isn't some magic spark between us. It's not about that. But the episode completely drops the ball on exploring what that means.
Yeah,
it just goes, oh, OK, well, we'll just go back into the game and find a way to do it. It's like, I think that's an interesting idea. It's not us. It's not this. We're not these star-crossed lovers that are just in the wrong bodies or whatever. It's something else. But the show never provides what that something else is.
Agreed. So I think it just like it really had some interesting ideas. There's a lot of things that were well executed, but there was not that much follow through in terms of like what the show was trying to say. This episode was trying to say. So.
Which is the problem plaguing the entire season, pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. So that is Striking Vipers, the first episode. And I thought there was more good than bad, but overall, not great. Not great. Let's talk about the second episode, Smithereens. So in Smithereens, we find out basically what happens when a character flips out and tries to get in touch with the founder of like basically a Facebook
Twitter
a Facebook thing. Equivalent. So in this episode, I'll read the plot summary. A rideshare driver takes an employee of Smithereen, a large social media company, hostage. Unlike most other episodes, this does not rely on near future technology. As a reminder that Black Mirror is not solely a science fiction show. So that is kind of the overall plot is like Andrew Scott, who you might know as Moriarty from Sherlock, and also he is
Fleabag,
hot priest in Fleabag season 2. He plays a rideshare driver and he like kind of accosts this social media employee for reasons that become clear as the episode goes on. So I have to say that, you know, every season of Fleabag, there's usually – I'm sorry. Every season of Black Mirror, there's usually like an episode that's like a straight-up procedural, right? That's like not very many science fiction elements, but like just straight-up procedural. This is that episode. And I have to say there are many things I liked about this episode.
Me too. This is my favorite of the season by far.
So Andrew Scott, obviously amazing performer, and he does a great job in this role. But what I really loved is everything that happens in terms of getting in touch with the head of Smithereens or Smithereen, I should say, felt extremely plausible. At a major tech company, like this felt like, oh yeah, I could totally see it playing out in exactly this way. Where, like, you know, the Penelope is like the COO or whatever. She's like jogging. She gets the call, and then she's like debating whether or not to actually bring in the CEO, because it's like, you only pull that lever if you, like, really absolutely need to.
Listen, especially, he's on a silent retreat.
Especially,
okay?
If he's on a silent retreat. And then the location of the silent retreat. Apparently, all those scenes were shot in Spain, and it looked incredible. Yeah, it looked extremely plausible. Like, that's what. So what I liked about this episode is, like, how plausible everything seemed, right? Like, how, like, it step by step, you see, like, what occurs when something like this were to happen, this major event were to happen. And it all felt like, I buy everything that happened this episode. Like, there's very little that I felt like was unbelievable. So,
well, I will say, like, the whole point of this episode, though, it is kind of like a morality tale about, like, social media addiction. And I don't think that final point really, really go, like, rams it home.
Yeah.
Okay, because I think Andrew Scott acts the hell out of this episode.
He does.
He adds so much to it. Damson Idris, like, as the person being held hostage, it's very, really good. Topher Grace as a sort of like aloof billionaire CEO who has no idea what he's created. Like, good stuff there. But what this episode hinges on is Andrew Scott just feeling like shit because he thinks like he caused this accident because he looked at a social media message. And I feel like, I don't know. I just wanted something more, like, for all of this, for this entire, you know, Dog Day Afternoon situation to kind of resolve around that. And he sells it, but it felt a little pat. It felt a little blunt. It felt like, oh, this is what this is about. We're addicted to our phones. That's it.
Thank you,
everybody. Good night.
I do agree that it was a little pat and a little blunt. But there were moments of brilliance. I was on the edge of my seat throughout this entire episode. And as the machinations of how this all escalates continue to roll out, I thought it was so tense and taut. And my favorite moment is when he finally gets Topher Grace on that line and finally gets him to you know, he starts saying, yeah, you know, I started making this company and I, you know, it's turned into something I don't, and he goes, I don't care. Stop. I don't care.
Yeah.
It's the best moment. Cause you feel like he's wanting to get the CEO to make that revelation of like, oh, we created something that horrible and maybe we should change. And he's like, no, I just wanted you to hear me. I just wanted to feel heard. And I thought that was so profound and so interesting, a choice to make. It was this small thing of just like, I need, in the same way that he was addicted to the social media thing of putting his feelings out and having someone respond to them.
Yeah.
He needed the ultimate response of the ultimate person who ran this thing. And that's all he cared about.
Yeah. I will say that was all very good. I will say I also didn't care for like where the ending goes.
Yeah.
Which just
so
feels
we
got
to talk about the ending, right? Which is,
yeah.
So before we get to the ending,
okay.
Just say that, like, I'll just say, that moment in particular, Jeff, really felt like it played out, pretty accurately. Like, this guy has gone through this whole trouble. He doesn't care about that. He doesn't care that Mark Zuckerberg is having a moment, right?
Right. I'm not here to provide catharsis for you.
Right. He's here for himself, obviously.
Yeah.
It's a very selfish act, what Andrew Scott does, that kind of fills it out. I do think that the Topher Grace coming to terms and like, oh, it's out of my control, blah, blah, blah. Like, that is that felt very wish fulfillment-y. And what I mean by that is like, it's like what we wish Mark Zuckerberg would say or think. But I don't believe that's the reality.
Why I love them throwing that away is because it feels like the episode is building to that moment of like, oh, we've all wanted Mark Zuckerberg to go, yes, Facebook is evil. I created something bad. And then he finally gets there and the guy's like, shut up. I don't care. You know, that's why I liked the whole episode throwing that away. I also really liked the idea of this Facebook entity knowing more than the police at every turn.
That was pretty terrifying. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is the time when Facebook would pull out the big guns, right? Is like, hey, when one of your employees' life is being threatened, I can totally imagine Facebook invoking God mode, which is a thing that's been confirmed to exist.
Yeah. Look at all the things we can do if we need to, if we want to.
Right.
Now's the time when we can do them. And we have had this ability the entire time. You know, it's like that they didn't make a big deal about that. But it really was the thing that I felt was the best part of this episode is that level of the tech of these suits in this room who've been elected by nobody and overwatched by nobody have the power to do things far more effectively and efficiently than the police themselves.
Right. Telling the CIA basically to like fuck off. Like,
yeah.
I think it was the FBI actually, but
yeah, it was FBI. Yeah.
But the part that I thought was like wish fulfillment-y that kind of bothered me, Jeff, is like that the show, if we take Topher Grace's character to be kind of a Mark Zuckerberg avatar, then the show kind of absolves Zuckerberg of responsibility in a way. Like I felt like he is now created something that is beyond his control that he cannot control, which I just
that doesn't absolve of responsibility. I think it just says like it's not the fact that maybe it's not malicious, but he's literally ignorant and is not able to control this thing. Like he's still responsible for it. But
well,
I don't think
he's ignorant. He's aware of what the terrible things that the company's doing. I'm just saying
that's not what they set out to do, right? The intent wasn't there for that. And I think that's very different.
But I don't think the intent is there in real life either. That's what I'm saying. Anyway, that's my position is that I think that this episode in some way, in some ways absolves the Mark Zuckerberg character of responsibility, which is, I don't think would be true in real life. Like, I don't buy that that's the dynamic
but
in real life. So
I do think it's not just Mark Zuckerberg, right? This guy kind of seems more like a Jack Dorsey character to me because there is a Facebook replacement in this episode. That's Persona. That's another company. So this one, different kind of a social network. We know about Dorsey, silent retreats and everything.
Right.
And Dorsey strikes me as a guy, you know, who I've sat in with him for interviews. Like I've seen him talk quite a bit. He strikes me as a guy who has no clue what's going on around him.
Yeah.
You know, basically. So
yeah, you're right. That actually is probably a better analog is Dorsey rather than Zuckerberg. So good call.
So it's like this thing is being built. You know, he was a hacker kid who was just like in a good place at a good time. And, you know, things spun out of control. Basically, and I found that interesting at least.
Let's talk about the ending, which I understood what it was trying to do, right? It's trying to say, like, hey, regardless of the outcome, people will look on their phones for like 3 seconds and then not give a shit anymore, right? Like, that is how desensitized and inured we are to all the like constant, you know, flood of shit flowing into our social media accounts. Like that is the extent to which we don't even care anymore that like something this remarkable can happen and people just peek at it and they move on. Right. I understand that's what it was trying to do. Still found it to be pretty frustrating though. Jeff, what'd you think of the ending? Like, were you okay with not finding out what happens?
I think it's pretty clear what happens. I think he was shot. But I all.
How do you think that's clear though?
Yeah, like yeah.
The sound of the gunshot ringing out.
But how do you don't know where to aim? Yeah.
But like the question is not whether someone dies. The question is who dies, right?
Yes.
Like it's possible both of them died. It's possible the intern died.
Nobody died. They could have just missed it entirely. Yeah.
It didn't seem to me to be as mysterious as all that. I came away thinking. He died. He forfeited his life as he intended, as he wanted to have happen. But to me, I was struck by the act of giving the mother the password into her daughter's account.
Yeah.
And that really actually kind of got me a little bit.
That was a nice moment.
It was. Yeah. It was. But also the gunshot rang out the moment she got in. Right. So it was like this idea of
the gunshot happened when she hit enter.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
Everybody.
Yeah, it's we're killing ourselves with this stuff. I didn't really take away what you said about, you know, it's a moment that people notice and then they get over. It's more like we're killing ourselves with this stuff for what? You know,
oh, wow. We have very different interpretations of the ending. I mean, I think the episode is extremely purposeful in not showing you any of what happens when the gunshot rings. Like Jeff, regardless of what you think happened, the episode didn't show you for a reason.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's trying to say something by not showing you.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of why I extrapolate to my interpretation.
Yeah. And I think mine's a little different too. Like I didn't get the whole thing. Like we'll just ignore this. To me, it just felt like it is so open-ended in a way as to be like completely obtuse and kind of meaningless. Like it is so like choose your own adventure ending in a way that just made me kind of roll my eyes. Like, I wish this was a great point for him to actually say something, to make a point. And it doesn't feel like the show wanted to do any of that.
I thought it did try to make a point, and I don't agree with the steps.
Where are you getting the bits that we'll just forget about it quickly? Like,
because you see multiple shots of people getting notifications. They look at it for like literally 2 seconds. They put it away. They go on with their day. That motif is repeated over and over again in that final sequence, and I think it is trying to indicate the disposability of social media notifications, of social media news. It's just being like, oh, like, hey, this life or death situation that was such a massive, like, kept us on the edge of our seats for an hour, is just like dismissed as like drivel by the masses, right? Like that, it's just social media has desensitized us to like anything important.
I don't know if that's necessarily the case either, but yeah, I could see your reading.
Yeah.
To me, it's also like, I think of like when I get those alerts, like, guys, there's only so much we can process. The world is a hellscape. I don't think it's about social media like inuring us to it. It's more like, oh God, I cannot take this. I cannot take this one thing. Okay. So some guy was shot. Okay. Well, yeah, I got to worry about what my kids are doing, for breakfast.
I mean, but the whole episode, like the reason he took them hostage is because, he was too addicted to looking at things. And then I felt I thought it was a good kind of like undercutting at the end to be like, hey, like everyone's looking at this stuff all the time. But by the way, it is like a tiny part of their day that has no significance whatsoever.
I think so. I maybe missed some of those cutaway scenes because like they happen like after
they happen in the credits. That's right.
And I hate that. I do hate that because I don't know when to stop watching.
Fair enough.
You stop watching when the thing decides to send you into the next episode for 4 seconds.
Yeah. All right.
Let me ask you this question. Do you guys think his plan was always that? Or do you think he improvised the call to Zuckerberg because the plan went awry? But do you think he wanted to kidnap a high level executive for the express purpose of getting a hold of Zuckerberg?
Yeah, I think so.
That was the whole plan. Yeah. And the hitch in this plan was that he kidnapped an intern, basically.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. All right. Final episode. Of like, this has been fun to talk about with you guys, even though I'm having more fun talking about it with you than I did watching the episodes.
This is the best part of Black Mirror, is the discussion. Yeah.
So Rachel, Jack, and Ashley too. This I would say was the dumbest out of the three episodes.
By far.
And I think that, like, again, as you guys pointed out, opens really strong. The idea, like, I actually love the Ashley too, like the design of that character. In some ways based after the cylinder that the company I work for puts out.
What could that be? And also like Eve from WALL-E,
a little
Eve from WALL-E. I
will say the most frightening thing for me this entire season, the most like bone chilling thing in Black Mirror was the popified version of Head Like a Hole. Like, my God.
What is the deal with that? Is the deal with, like, using Nine Inch Nails? In the Black Mirror universe, Nine Inch Nails didn't exist, but...
It's, like, rewritten. It's rewritten, too, to be positive and uplifting. And I think that'll, like, the function of it being so weird and so, like, it kind of makes my skin crawl because it's, like, this is not right. Very bad. And Trent Reznor, like, gave his okay to all this, of course. So, like,
it was a bizarre choice.
The very teeny bopper version of it at the beginning, terrifying, maybe at the end where it's like literally just the song Head Like a Hole, where it's more rocky, like it kind of makes more sense. I wish the show had like leaned more into that, like what led to that, because she just says it's the lyrics come from my dreams, basically.
Yeah, so one of the things I thought was pretty cool about this episode is that like it uses ideas that have been brought up in previous Black Mirror episodes, right? So like the idea that you can duplicate an entire consciousness, and you know that you can put that onto a chip and blah blah blah, like that's pretty interesting. And the show has come back to that well many, many times, but I do like the economy of like, hey, you know, we don't need to spend like 30 minutes explaining like how this thing works. Like, you've already seen previous episodes. We can just say, hey, her entire mind is on there. Like, let's move on.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and so I kind of appreciate the economy of that.
I have some, if you want to talk about economy, I have some things that I need to say about this episode.
Do it.
One of which, if you're talking about economy, we have maybe an all-time most shoehorned explanation, most take, what do they call that? Walk your dog around the block to get to the entire reason that the dad is working on a humane rat thing. It is such a huge part of the show that they take so much effort to establish that he is trying to create a humane rat solution.
He has a rat car.
All of that. All of the things that he's down in his basement all of the time. He's busy all the time. All of that is in the show. There is so much effort put in simply so we can have one moment where the girls get on the computer and go blip, blip. Okay, her whole consciousness is on here. It is so... You talk about economy. It is the opposite of economy.
Well, Jeff, to be fair, they also use the rat electrocution device later in the episode, right? They couldn't have broken into Miley Cyrus's house without that electric rat.
David, do not get me started on that. You have a bodyguard for the biggest pop star in the world whose primary audience is young women. And two young women come to the door in an outfit saying, "We're supposed to be here." And he goes, "Okay.
Sure."
You have got to be kidding me. He, literally the target audience, the most rabid fan base of the biggest pop star in the world, that exact demographic, which doesn't make any sense that there are rat catchers, right? Comes to the door in a ill-fitting rat catcher suit, and this dude goes, "Oh, I don't want to lose my job. I don't want to not catch the rats that I haven't
seen."
Nobody
said he was good at his job, you know. I like the way this episode is basically like an Amblin movie of just like kids getting into hijinks, and your tolerance of that, I think, depends on like how much you enjoy
it. I do think that the whole rat catching thing did make this episode way more silly.
Jumped the shark, dude. Maybe you can describe it as an Amblin movie, but I describe it more like a cartoon. We are in the wackiest Eddie Murphy vehicle from the mid 90s, and
with
it's
a Dumb and Dumber car, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, and we're running down the street with Miley Cyrus doing riffs with herself on the robot. It is so stupid, so stupid. And for what? To like arrive in the theater and go, "Stop." Okay, she stopped. I mean, I don't. What?
Luckily,
what
this is
that?
A theater you can drive into. That's that seems like a really nice perk. Yeah.
Yeah. This is a pretty pretty rough episode.
It's profoundly dumb.
But the first 30 minutes is really good, though. You know, like, the idea of her, like, kind of being obsessed with this thing. And, like, I think, actually, the Amazon Cylinder, like, there's actually a program where you can actually have conversations with it. And the idea of, like, exploring that, like, what happens when these cylinders like become really conversant, and like, will they become like better friends than actual humans? I think that's extremely possible. And for the episode to bring up that idea and then just completely jettison it, you know, like, it has nothing at all to say about that.
David, there is no universe in which there wasn't a moment in the writing of this episode where he got to the point where he's like, "I got to figure out how these girls can unlock the full memory. They're just two girls. How do they unlock? Okay, I know what I'll do. I'll go back to the beginning and I'll make their dad working on neural net for rats." You have got to be kidding me.
Like, couldn't they have made, you know, one of the girls a computer hacker or something? Yeah. You know what I mean?
Clumsiest, most...
The thing about neural nets, Jeff, like, the thing about neural nets, it's kind of like nanobots, your favorite. We don't know how they work. We kind of just put data into them and things spit out. And we're like, okay, I guess this works. But we don't even fully understand them. It's kind of hilarious. Like, the output of it is just like this weird mystery thing.
Yeah.
I think the big issue with this episode is it basically covers ground that already has been trod better in other Black Mirror episodes, right?
Sure.
Sure. 50 Million Merits, is that the episode, right?
50 Million Merits, that is my favorite episode. I think that episode is fantastic because it does such a good job of giving us characters. It builds this world. Like, it does so many cool things. This is like, this is an 80s kids movie, basically.
The idea of what it takes to achieve fame, the idea of like preserving consciousness has already been done better in other episodes. Like, this episode has very little to add. I will say the one moment in this episode that I was like, that is brilliant. first of all, this moment came after something that happened that I thought was really dumb, which was they're like, hey, by isolating her neural patterns, we can like achieve notes. We can figure out what notes are. Right? Like, so it's like looking at the Matrix or whatever, which is just like, wow, that is a incredibly cumbersome way of writing down songs. Like, it would take like weeks to do like a 1 minute song. You know, like it's nuts that they think that that's the way to do it. But there is that moment when they're like, he has that interface up, and she's like singing this really sad song, and she's like, you know, give it a beat, tweak it, like make it more upbeat and, you know, like chirpy. And like he does it like in real time. And then you hear like the same song in a different way. And it's like, oh, wow, that could actually be on the radio, you know? And I was like, I really appreciated like how like it gets at the fluidity of music and how like with different producing, the same song and the same lyrics can sound and feel really different. Of course, the thing I'm describing was like literally 20 seconds of a 1 hour episode.
Yeah.
That was really cool when they did that. So.
It hints at a lot of cool things, like the idea of having also virtual pop stars, which exist right now. If you had somebody at the level of like Miley Cyrus who could be projected in giant hologram form, which I'm sure some pervy guys will really enjoy. There's a lot of that. Like, there's a lot of cool potential of like what you could do with that character. But again, just brought up briefly and then kind of dropped. Like, I think all these episodes could use more time. Maybe if they had a little more room to breathe, maybe we'd get more from them.
There's nothing about that version of Ashley O at the end, that virtual version of her, that is a usable substitute for the real person. Like, there's nothing about that technology that somehow is better than just playing a pre-recorded video of the actual person. Yeah.
But you can't have a concert. You can't have a concert without that giant thing, you know.
But I just don't understand how they think people will buy tickets to see what is clearly.
I think people are buying tickets for hologram concerts right now, Jeff. Like right now, to see dead celebrities, basically. I don't know how big it is, but that is a thing that's happening.
Yeah, yeah. I think Devendra's right about that. So
you know, I feel you on the Tupac thing, but and you know others, it's going to be a thing. But the pitch that she was making in the show of how like you know, it never gets tired, it never gets it's like neither does videotape, which we have.
Jeff, in 5 years or so, if somebody was like, we have digitized prints. We have the full essence of Prince, and it's backed by his estate and everything. And you can go there and see a giant life-size Prince, you know, realistically do this whole thing. I think you'd be down with that. But I think you'd pay money for that.
What the show showed us. I mean, yes. First of all, yes. But second of all,
you're right. You're right.
What the show showed us was a mo-capped actor off stage playing her.
It was actually freaking hilarious, to be honest.
Yeah. But like, this is my problem, and I'm being inarticulate presenting it to you. My problem is the idea that they were saying is that somehow we are able to create the essence of her and extract it because we've actually mapped her AI into this thing. So it's like you're watching her alive now. But what the show showed us is that's not at all what they
were
doing.
It's just literally a random person dancing like Ashley O. Right?
Yes. Yeah. It's just literally a mo-capped pre-recorded video.
Yeah.
It's like there's nothing special about that.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with you that was weird, like that they didn't go far enough with the AI components of it. So
like, I'm not there yet. They have the technology to transfer consciousness. They do not have AI dancing. Right. It is too complex.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is our review of the last episode of Black Mirror Season 5, Rachel, Jack, and Ashley 2. It has overall been a mixed bag of a season, but some of the stuff is so well done that it like kind of, you know, I just don't know how to quit this show.
It's right? still worth watching. Like, yeah. That's the thing.
Don't know how to quit
watching, worth talking about. It's a good water cooler show.
We're hoping for more episodes. You don't feel like this is a downward trend?
I feel like
Bandersnatch took the amount of time it would make to do three episodes, basically. Like, they filmed a lot of stuff. It was a big production. Maybe next season, like, they can be back to six or something. Three does feel like too little. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm up for giving it another shot, Jeff. I'm going to return to the well one more time, possibly for the last time, depending on how the next season goes. So there was more here to like than not like, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But at times, it got pretty close. So, all right.
I would have turned off Striking Vipers if I could have. I mean, mostly because my mom was sitting next to me, but.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode of the Slash Filmcast. Find more episodes at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. And stay tuned to hear what we'll be discussing next week. In the meantime, Kanata, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, you can always follow me on Twitter at Jeff Kanata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I do a video game podcast called DLC, and this is E3 week. So we actually did some extra content. We did a big E3 press conference episodes, two of them this week already. And we're going to do a big E3 wrap-up show at the end of the week. So it's 5x5.tv/DLC or anywhere you get podcasts. And I'm also doing a live play Dungeons & Dragons show, which, if that all sounds weird and foreign to you, basically it's a improvised storytelling medium akin to something like Game of Thrones. And I'm really proud of it. You heard one of our emailers early in the show talk about how I think it was she who was enjoying it, getting so many positive reactions. I hope listeners of the show will give it a shot. I want to keep making it, and I'm really, really proud of the thing we're creating. You can find that on YouTube or as an audio podcast. It's called The Dungeon Run. Or you can watch it live and actually impact the story in real time on Wednesday nights at 6 p.m. Pacific time on caffeine.tv/The Dungeon Run.
Devendra Hardware.
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech and gadget.com. I'm also doing a tech podcast at nomoretech.net. That's no with a K.
And check out the video that my wife and I made about Always Be My Maybe. You can find it at youtube.com/Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y. Next week, we'll be discussing Men in Black International. And I just got to say, it has been a rough summer for the sequels this year.
Oh, man.
It has been a rough summer for the sequels so far. And we will see if Men in Black International continues that trend or not. Next week on The Slash.
This is Acast Recommends. Every week we pick one of our favorite shows, and this is one we think you're going to love.
Who exploded Vivian Stone? Was it Screen Hunk McSalad?
Mother's Digest called me dependably erotic.
Leading lady Joanna Shoebags.
Oh, you call me dramatic again, I will die!
First time director Wallace Byrne Matravers.
I think I'll just keep my clothes on for now.
Assistant director Laura Sidesalad.
If I can help you direct this film, I can certainly help direct your winkle.
Technician James Wigington.
You've got a funny way of addressing a man holding a power drill.
Or someone else entirely. Listen in to find out who exploded Vivian Stone.
Acast is home to the biggest podcasts from the UK and around the world. Subscribe to this show and hundreds more now via Acast or wherever you get your podcasts.